Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio this Sunday, November 4th. I am so delighted that you're with us tonight. We have a load of special guests. Chuck Cox, that's Susan Powell's father, will be here shortly to talk about the latest in the case. Mark Klass of the Klass Kids Foundation will join us, as well as Michael Lay, whose sister Michelle was murdered last year, and Michelle's killer just got convicted of first-degree murder, and we're going to get into all that in just a moment. But, you know, wow, so much crime and so little time. I'll tell you, I am so sick of crime. I would love for this show and the true crime discussion forums to either be gone or have very little to talk about. Here's what we need to do. We need to figure out how these homegrown monsters come to be. What are the seeds that plants in their evil little minds and starts to grow? Okay, hypothetical here. Let's say we find out without a doubt that the way to raise up somebody like Josh Powell or the killer of Polly Klass or the killer of Michelle Lay is abuse, child abuse. Sexual abuse, child abuse, it's something in the home. How do we as a society step in and stop it? Let's say it's horrific verbal abuse. That can be just as bad. If it's horrific verbal abuse, what do we do? I mean, Child Protective Services, they're already overworked. They can't step in because a dad's yelling at a kid. I don't have the answer other than if we make it known what not to do, just maybe we can stop growing these monsters in the United States, and that's what I would like to see happen. Joining us tonight is Chuck Cox, and Mr. Cox, I do apologize. I was in a different time zone than you, and so I do apologize. I told you I'd be calling you an hour from now, and I called you an hour early, so thank you for being so patient with me.
Not a problem.
Mr. Cox, recently there's been some news, and your daughter Susan has been missing since December 6, 2009. Now, it's obvious to anyone with a working brainstem that her husband, Josh Powell, is guilty in her disappearance. In February of this year, Josh killed himself and murdered his two sons, your grandsons, by blowing up his home. Since then, you found out that Josh had a multi-million dollar insurance policy, with the beneficiaries being Josh's brother and sister. He removed Susan from the insurance policy, even though she paid for it, really. I mean, she paid for everything. Josh hardly did anything. You are fighting the beneficiaries to try and get that money. Can you explain to us what's going on and why you're doing that?
Yeah, well, basically it was as a result of an interpleader. The life insurance company involved decided they couldn't figure it out on their own who should be paid the money. They were aware of Josh, and he had made some changes in beneficiary back in October, which was right after we had just gotten the kids in 2011, when we just gotten the kids into our control, basically, where we could actually talk with them and see our grandchildren again. And then in December 2011, he again changed the beneficiary. And both times he was under a lot of duress. And, of course, he didn't have the right to change it anyway. It was just kind of an attack. But the life insurance policy, life insurance company, filed a suit, and it's called an interpleader suit. Basically, it named the life insurance company versus any possible beneficiaries of the policy, which included Josh's brother and sister, younger brother and sister, his mother, my wife, myself, anybody who had any chance getting that money or, you know, being paid up by the insurance policy. So we actually had no choice but to respond to the interpleader filed by the insurance company. And the only reason we found out about that was Michael and Alina Powell went after the money themselves. And when they did that, of course, we found out the policies existed. And, of course, having our daughter missing and at the hands of her husband, somehow, you know, and then to have him now attempt to it's clear that life insurance policy was intended for him to live the rest of his life once he you know, Mira actually decided it or came forward with the idea that she's actually dead and had her declared dead, and then he would have that money. So now what he's planning on doing is make sure that he gives it to his brothers and sisters. And we're not going to let him do that. We're not
letting
him.
Good for you.
So we're fighting that, and we have a good legal team working on it, and we'll see where all that goes. But it's not that we don't, that we want the money for ourselves. I would rather give it to charity. I would rather go someplace else, just because they should not benefit from the things they've done.
Well, that's exactly right. Josh Powell's family should not benefit from the fact that his father, Stephen, and Josh are the monsters that I talk about, and his family shouldn't get $2.5 million because these people have gone around and done these horrible things. You're absolutely right. Let's say you are awarded all of the money, $2.5 million, if I'm not mistaken. Do you have any idea what you'll do with it?
Well, I know the attorneys will get some.
Mm-hmm. Yes, oh, yes.
It takes a lot to battle. But then I would like to do is use it with the Susan Cox Powell Foundation, and then from there distribute it out. If they won't let me do that, well then I'll just let send it out to other charities anyway, like the Chain Breakers Foundation out of Utah, or the Tears Foundation, Friends and Family of Domestic Violence Domestic Crime Victims, and the other charities along those lines that are battling domestic abuse and domestic violence.
That would be amazing. And there is no doubt in anybody's mind, Mr. Cox, that that's exactly what you do with your with the money. And if anybody questions why you're going after the money, then they don't know you and your wife and Susan's family, because you are the epitome of a decent human being, and how you've handled yourself in all of these situations, I don't know. You're a very patient man. I think I would have been in jail by now, because I would have absolutely slugged somebody, and that probably would have been Josh's father, Stephen. Now he is in jail right now, and talk about a case of the acorn not falling far from the tree. It's these two. Stephen is in jail on various charges, including child porn. Do you know if the investigators are trying to still talk to him? Because we know he knows where Susan is. Do you think he'll talk? Are they trying to talk to him? What's going on with that? Do you know anything?
Well, they've tried to talk to him. He's refusing to talk to the police, asserting his Fifth Amendment rights, which, of course, clearly to any thinking person knows, he's guilty. He had was directly or indirectly involved in it, and he doesn't want to spend more time in jail. So right now he doesn't have any reason to talk about it, as far as I know, because if he talks to him, he'll just end up spending more time in jail. I'm just hoping, and I believe the police have evidence that they'll be able to bring forth to prove, without his cooperation, that he was involved, in which case, regardless, he's going to spend more time in jail.
Exactly. And we've talked about this before, but let's remind everybody your feelings on this. If they went to Stephen Powell and said, okay, you tell us where Susan is, and we won't charge you with any part of this particular crime, what are your feelings on that?
He needs to be in jail. This guy's a monster, and I want him away from you know, if I don't find my daughter because he won't talk, I still want him in jail. I don't want him walking free, just holding my daughter's wherever she is. That is the bit that makes him free man. There's no way that should be right. So I'm more interested in keeping him behind jail, because I know where I know he's a danger to society, and you know, that's just not right.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I agree with you, and thank you for thinking of society, because you're right. If he doesn't get life in prison, he'll get out and he'll keep doing those horrible things that he and Josh and God knows what other of his kids do these things as well. So you're absolutely right. And Mr. Cox, I know it's dinner time, and again, I apologize for the time mix-up, but we're talking with Mr. Cox, and Mr. Cox is Susan Powell's father. And Mr. Cox, on behalf of Web Sleuths and everybody I know, if there's anything we can ever do, you let us know, and we are behind you 100%.
And Web Sleuths has actually helped out. You know, we were looking for some information, and you provided it for us. That was great. And you know, what we're doing is we're battling evil, and the fact that you're an ally in that is very beneficial to everyone.
Well, thank you, and we'll always be there for you. Mr. Cox, thank you so much. I'll let you get back to your family. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, let's go to Mark Klass and Michael Lay. Mark Klass, wow, what a guy. Isn't he great?
Yeah, he's got a lot of integrity. There's no question about it. And he's displayed that throughout the entire process.
He really has. And let's welcome Michael Lay. Michael, your sister Michelle was murdered, and we'll be talking about that in just a little bit. But what did you think of Chuck Cox, Susan Powell's father?
You know, he just sounds like a real stand-up guy, and you know, once you've been through this process before, you just feel for everyone who's you know, a victim's family and who has to deal with the legal system, and just wishing justice, like real fair justice for the murder of their loved ones.
Thank you. And let me just give a little brief background here. I had the great pleasure of having dinner with Michael Lay and meeting and speaking with him, along with Mark Klass and many other volunteers in the Klass Kids Foundation. We went to St. Louis this year for our big print-a-thon. That's where I met Michael. Michael, you are such a classy, upstanding young man. For what you've been through and how you've handled yourself is, again, I don't know how you and people like Mark Klass and Chuck Cox do it, because I think I would be in jail. But let's talk about your sister, Michelle. Tell us a little bit about your sister, Michelle, first.
My sister was born October 12th, 1984. She is 3 years older than me. And growing up, we would fight a lot. But it was kind of funny. Out of thin air, when my mom passed away in 1999, we really bonded together. And she would always look after me, and she would take every moment she could to tell me that she loved me. And she would even nag me when we would leave. I wouldn't say it back. She would always remind me until I did. I remember the last voicemail. The last thing I ever heard from her was, it was during 2011 when everyone thought the world was going to end. And she took that as a way to leave me a voicemail and said, I just wanted you to know that I love you, just in case the world ends. And I just wish that I told her more often.
Well, I'm sure she knows. I'm sure she knows. And she was murdered in 2011. By one of the monsters that we've been talking about. Let's bring in Mark Klass. Mark, your foundation searched for Michelle Lay, and she was found, thank God. How do you think it all went down? Now, the trial, first of all, the person that killed Michelle was a former friend, and she was very jealous of Michelle's relationship with her former friend. I don't even know if it was her boyfriend, but she had a baby with this guy, and Michelle was friendly with him, and this woman was very, very jealous of her, to the point where she stalked them and harassed them. Anyway, it came to trial, and Mark, you were at the trial. Give us your thoughts on the trial. How did it look? Were you worried it wasn't going to be first-degree murder?
Well, let's give it a little context. Even the defense admitted that Giselle Esteban murdered or killed Michelle, but they said that it was an involuntary manslaughter in the moment of passion kind of a thing. But I think that the prosecution did an amazing job of demonstrating that this was well planned, that it was a festering wound that had gone on for years and years. And she had basically telegraphed everything that she was going to do, and then they basically got everything documented that she did do. And the one thing that's missing is a videotape of her murdering Michelle. And that really was the only thing missing, and that's only because that particular surveillance camera was not working at the time the crime occurred. Now, this gal, this monster, really, Giselle Esteban, thought that Michelle was responsible for everything in her miserable life, that if Michelle wasn't around, then she and Scott would be living happily ever after. They'd have a nuclear family. They'd take vacations in the Bahamas. She'd be popular with friends and family and maybe be a prom queen. I don't know. But the reality is that she had no friends, that her family had disowned her, that she had lost custody of her child, that Scott, the man who was her boyfriend at one time, had taken out a restraining order against her, and it had absolutely nothing to do with Michelle Lay. I never met Michelle, but I understand that she was a beautiful young lady. She was very giving. She was a nursing student, for goodness sake. She wanted to follow in her mother's footsteps. Michael already talked about his relationship with her, and, you know, she was loved by many, and many were at the trial to support the family, including myself. And, I thought that the prosecutor did a wonderful job of explaining and proving first-degree murder, but the jury was gone for more than a week, and I became very, very concerned that they would come back with something less than first-degree murder and the mandatory 25-to-life sentence that would be mandated by such. And I will let Michael tell you how that turned out, because he was there when the jury came back and I wasn't.
Michael, take us through that time when the jury walked in. I mean, I can't imagine what you were feeling. I would have been a nervous wreck.
Yeah, it was crazy. We didn't even believe it, because we had been coming in, staying at Christine's house day in and day out. And after the first 3 days, we just kind of expected that it would be the next day. And, you know, 5 days doesn't sound like that long, but you have to take into context that the trial ended on a Thursday, and so they had it for that weekend unofficially, and then they took the whole week and then another weekend, and so it was more like 10, 11 days. And for 10, 11 days, for a verdict that seemed so black and white, we were extremely nervous that it would be second degree or even voluntary manslaughter. And so when we finally heard that there was a verdict, we just freaked out, and everyone just jumped into a higher gear. There was clothes flying everywhere. Everyone was getting ready, and then we just made a mad dash to the courtroom. And then we waited for maybe about an hour until we can finally sit down. But even then, our whole family, we just held hands, more like death grips,
mm-hmm.
because we didn't know what to expect. And then when the verdict was finally read, it was still a little confusing. They said she was guilty of murder, of something, and we weren't sure until they said first degree. And everyone just did a silent kind of like whoop in their head.
Mm-hmm.
Hands were shaking. Everyone was crying, and we didn't know why we were crying. We weren't crying because we were, you know, overwhelmed with happiness, and not overwhelmed with sadness, but just a sense of relief that the jury did the right thing.
I was going to say, it's a big, huge emotional release, and that's usually what people do when an emotional release happens. They either get mad or cry, so that's very understandable. We're talking with Michael Lay, whose sister Michelle was murdered, and we also have Mark Klass with us, the head of the Klass Kids Foundation. Of course, we know his daughter Polly Klass was murdered in 1993. Like I said, I am so sick of these people getting out there and hurting our loved ones. Michael, when the jury came in, did they look at you? That's always, they say, a clue that the jury goes in your favor. Did they look at you at all, your family?
I believe they did, but I was too scared that I was looking to the floor. But a few of our family members said that they felt like they were looking at us. And so it was a good sign, but nothing was for certain until the verdict was read.
Let's go back a while here. Now, Michelle had problems, and Mark, thank you for explaining the background. That was eloquent. That was perfect. Michelle had problems with this woman. Her boyfriend, Scott, got a restraining order against her because she was so insistent that Michelle was the problem. And like Mark said, she basically told everybody exactly what she was going to do, and the only thing missing was a videotape of the murder. I'm sure Michelle talked to you about this. Was she afraid for herself, for her safety in any way?
You know, my sister has always been very confident, And she's had problems with Giselle since high school. I just remember this time when Giselle trashed her room, stole her car, and left it lying somewhere just because she didn't return a board game to her. It was, and, you know, it's things like that. And she's always been, I guess, a problem. But Michelle always, I would always worry about her. You know, I took martial arts and I said, do you want to learn anything? And she's like, no, I got it. I do cardio kickboxing. I'll be fine. You know, and she was always sure that she would be okay. And, you know, no one ever really thinks that an enemy is, especially for that reason, would be capable of killing.
Well, so early on, I mean, they were friends in high school, correct?
Right.
Well, how could they remain friends after something like that? That's just psycho. That's psycho bitch turbo type of behavior. So, I mean, wow.
Yeah.
Were they friends after that, or was that kind of the beginning of the end?
That was kind of the beginning of the end. After high school, I think they tried to stay in touch, but eventually they just fell out of touch.
Did she ever apologize to Michelle?
You know, I don't think so. I don't think so. I think, you know, they just let it go.
And when did Michelle tell you that things were kind of getting scary, that she was starting to get out of control? When did that start happening?
You know, I don't think Michelle was ever fully aware of it. I think her friends would have better insight in that. But every now and then she would say, oh, you know, someone egged my car, someone sent me threatening texts. But it was never enough to call the police. And she never told it to me in a tone that really seemed serious enough. And to this day, I sometimes wonder if there was anything I could have done differently. And it just kills me sometimes.
You know what? That I'm sure everyone's told you, don't do that. That'll eat you up. And remember, there's only one person responsible for Michelle's murder. One person, and it's that monster. I don't even like to say her name. Mark, let me just jump back to the trial of Polly's killer. Now, it was the trial for the death penalty or life in prison. Was that correct? He had pleaded guilty, right?
Well, there's two phases in a death penalty trial. There's the guilt phase, when the jury determines whether or not the person is guilty of the crimes that they have been charged with. And then if they do find enough compelling evidence to find them guilty, then they have the penalty phase, when they bring in the psychologist and they do all the extenuating circumstances, blah, 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 and determine whether or not that individual then deserves life without the possibility of parole or the death penalty. And in both cases, they found him guilty of all charges, and then they found that there was enough reason that he should be sentenced to death. And let me just say that in California and in the country in general, only 2% of killers even achieve that threshold. You don't just kill somebody and automatically get charged with a death penalty crime. It has to be during the commission of some other type of a crime, such as a breaking and entering, a kidnapping, a rape. And if you have those extra circumstances, then one can qualify for the death penalty. Quite frankly, I believe that Giselle Esteban would have qualified for the death penalty, but they decided, and I think because she was a woman and because she was pregnant, that they would never get that kind of a conviction, and I think they're probably right at this point. So they went for 25 to life instead.
She's pregnant?
She was, yeah. When she murdered her, she was pregnant.
Is she still pregnant? I mean, or did she have the baby? Or
no, I think she had the baby.
And
I'm sure
hoping.
I'm not sure if the baby was a boy, a girl, or the devil, though.
God, exactly. Oh, good. I hope to hell they took that baby away from her and from her family. Because, you know, just get it to some decent family that needs a little baby.
You know,
Trace.
I mean, I don't know if Michael will agree with this, but I attended many sessions of the trial, and I never heard that she came from a rotten family at all.
Mm-hmm.
Really? Her father was there, and he sat very quietly and listened to everything. And, you know, he must have been brokenhearted. He didn't seem like a bad man or an evil man.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's not the family. Sometimes it's just a person. And I know that you spoke up at the beginning and talked about if all of these characters were victims of child abuse, et cetera, and that's not the case.
Well, I was
always,
saying,
sometimes they're just evil.
Well, I agree.
You know,
some
people are just evil.
What I was saying was, if we find out, that's what it is. It was just kind of a scenario. If we find out it's that, you're right. There are some people that are just born that way, and they have really nice parents, and they turn out to be psycho crazy. And it could be very true in this case, but there's always something in their background, I think, whether it's family.
I don't think so.
You think she was just born this way?
One of the great abuse excuse is that, well, you know, I turned out the way I am because I never got enough hugs, or my father beat me, or I was a victim of sexual exploitation when I was a child. And I think it's really easy to say that, but I don't think that that's by any means what really happens in all of these cases. And then I know that there are also many instances, probably many, many more instances, of people that do go through extreme abuse when they're children, and they use that as a defining moment in their lives to ensure that their children don't suffer as they did. I mean,
exactly.
I've been introduced to numerous people like that over the years. So, you know, for instance, the guy that murdered Polly, he didn't come from any kind of a pristine family. There's no question about that. But it was a family with four kids, and he is the only one that turned into a hardened criminal, and they all grew up under the similar circumstances.
Well, and I agree with absolutely everything you're saying, and my point is we need to find out, even if it's something organic in the brain, we need to find out what it is so we can stop these monsters from starting up. And I don't know what that entails. I really don't. And like I said at the beginning, it was just a what if we find out that it is all abuse, how do we stop it? No, it isn't always abuse. And that's the weird thing. It's what you just, all of those scenarios you gave are absolutely true. And that's what's so frustrating. How do we find out? How do we stop it?
But you're sort of talking about a minority report approach that find a way to predict future behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But then what? I mean, do you punish somebody because there's a 90% chance that at some point they will commit a crime despite the fact that they haven't committed a crime?
No.
I just don't know.
I don't know
what the answer is. What I do believe, and we're seeing the trends going in the opposite direction in California right now, is that if somebody's a hardened criminal, they should just be in prison for a long time. We're on the verge of overturning California's three strikes law and overturning California's death penalty. And it makes no sense to me in either instance why that anybody would be promoting that kind of an agenda. But the possibility exists that both of these pieces of legislation, both of these propositions, are going to pass. They're already letting numerous so-called low-risk offenders out of the California prison system, and those guys are going crazy with murders and rapes and attempted murders as we speak.
And you know what? Here's the thing, Mark. You're right. If someone commits a violent crime, they should just be in prison, because what it does is it takes away our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which we are all allowed to have. But when these people behave like this, they take it away from us. And I'm sick of people getting chance after chance after chance. I don't like the abuse excuse at all. I don't like it at all. If someone's abused and they turn out to be a monster, oh, well, you lock them up or give them the death penalty. I'm sorry that happened, but guess what? I need to protect you from the rest of, you know, so you don't go out and kill again or you don't go out and hurt somebody. I have no problem with the death penalty or locking people up. I can't believe California, of all places, they're going to overturn that. Haven't they? Don't the people know how well it's worked?
Apparently not.
Oh, my God.
I mean, the reality is that you have half the chance of being a victim of a violent crime in California today than you did in the year before three strikes was passed. But they've made the case that three strikes should be modified, and enough people are buying into this BS that there's an extremely good chance that that's going to pass.
I hope
it's
not.
It's extraordinary. It's unreal.
That must seem surreal. That must
too.
Seem surreal to you because you work so hard on the three strikes law and it works so well. That's
right.
What's frustrating.
Right.
Michael, let's get back to Michelle here. Oh, one quick question, Mark. How long did it take the jury to decide in Polly's case that he should get the death penalty?
About 6 days.
Did it? Did you about have a heart attack?
Well, no, but you wonder if the jury was sitting in on the same trial you were sitting in on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yeah.
That's the thing. You know, the people like me and Michael and, you know, others who are on that end of the criminal justice system, you sit through these things and, you know, like in our case and Michelle's case, the evidence was absolutely overwhelming. It was hugely overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think, well, the jury will go out and they'll take a vote and they'll come back and they'll hang the son of a bitch.
Right.
But that's not what happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
They spend days and days deliberating. It makes you crazy after a while.
I can't imagine what you were going through during that time. My God, it must have just been absolutely horrible. Michael, let's get back to Michelle for just a little bit. She was a nursing student. How old was she?
She was 26.
26. Now, was she going to, was Scott her boyfriend?
No, never. I mean, throughout, you know, as long as I've known her, she'd always introduced me to her boyfriend, and his name never came up.
His name was never associated with the phrase boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
So the monster that killed her had all this jealousy, and it sounds like she had jealousy for Michelle from years and years ago. She was obviously jealous of how, you know, Michelle's personality and her ability to draw people to her and her kindness. And she obviously just, it sent her over the edge, and that was just her excuse. What now for you and your family? Are you going to become active in these types of cases, or are you just going to take some time and regroup? What's next for the Lay family?
You know, even before the trial started, we, you know, our family has always wanted to give back, especially give back to Mark and the Class Kids Foundation for everything they've done. I mean, they are like real life superheroes to us. We just want to help them, help other missing person cases, and so we're just going to jump right back into the Sierra Lamar case. We're going to help searching. I hear there's another man missing in Hayward. That's contacted Brad, and so I just want to help, and I just want to do as much good for two people now.
Well, that's very admirable of you, and I know you'll find out that helping will definitely, definitely help you. Mark, any final thoughts on Michelle's case and Michael?
Well, yeah, I mean, Mikey's amazing. I mean, he really did. He jumped right in, as did Christine, his cousin, as did the entire family. They jumped right in, and they started giving back immediately. And you know, as you mentioned, it does tend to be therapeutic. I think it ultimately helps you a lot. Michael was the team leader of the search and rescue team that found remains of Linnea Lomax.
Mm-hmm. And you know? Mike... Right, and I'm so glad, Michael, to hear that you and your family are going to be working with the Class Kids Foundation, because Mark knows how I feel. You can't find a better group of people. They are just the most wonderful group. That's why Web Sleuths likes to help the Class Kids Foundation wherever we can as well. So I'm glad to hear that. I think you guys are going to make a fantastic team. Let's move on to another case here briefly. And this one is the one that, again, captured the nation, if not the world. And that's the Jessica Ridgway case. We've just found out she was sexually assaulted. I don't think that comes as a surprise to anybody. We've also just found out that her killer, who was 17, Austin Sigg, at the age of 15, was treated for addiction to pornography. Now, Mark, what does that mean to you? I've been trying to find a definition. I mean, does that mean that, you know, mom just found him looking at some stuff and wanted to run him to a shrink, or do you think it's more sinister?
Well, it was obviously more sinister. I this is the first I've heard of that, but that, you know, pornography is really, really easy to find online. You don't have to be any kind of a genius. You don't have to be 18 years old. All you have to do is have a computer and a browser, and you can find probably any kind of pornography that suits your fancy.
And I
think a lot of people look at that. I don't think the fact that somebody is into porn necessarily means that they're a bad person or that they're going to turn to a life of depravity. But certainly taken to its extreme, the consequences of that kind of activity is obvious for everybody who wants to pay attention. This is a bad, bad, bad man, this boy.
Oh, this kid is scary. The neighbors, they found a cat, their family pet, sliced open in half right by his house, by Austin Sieg's house. And they said then that Austin did it. So he was known as kind of a creepy kid. It's funny, you get two sides. You get people who say he was wonderful, and then you get other people who say he was just creepy and scary. And Mark and Michael, I don't know if you're aware of this story. There was a young girl, I believe about maybe 10 or 11, and this was before Jessica went missing. She was outside playing, and she came in, and her mom said, "Why'd you come in?" And she said, "Oh, there's this creepy guy staring at me, and I just came in." And she says, "Well, good for you." Well, Jessica went missing, and this little girl said, "I know it's that guy that was staring at me. I know it was." And the mom was kind of like, "Oh," she didn't say this, but she was thinking, "Oh, yeah, you know, maybe she's being a bit dramatic." And then when the picture was thrown up on the screen, the little girl goes, "That's him. That's him. That's the guy that was staring at me." So he was obviously out looking for victims, obviously, because he tried to kidnap a 22-year-old jogger. But he was on the prowl for a long time. And what's interesting is that little girl saw that look in his face and hightailed it back in the house. And I think that a lot of that has to do with education, how we're training our kids to, you know, trust your gut feeling and trust your feeling if you see a stranger that's just there and you get a bad feeling, move away, go in a house. I found that story interesting, didn't you, Mike or Mark?
Well, yeah, of course it's interesting. And, you know, a lot of serial killers, Jeffrey Dahmer is a very good example, start out killing animals.
Mm-hmm.
They start out with little pets, and they escalate ultimately to human beings. So I think it's pretty obvious that what we got here is a serial killer in training. And if the authorities hadn't pulled this guy in, if his mother hadn't called the authorities on him, there's no doubt that there would have been many, many, many more victims in the future.
And let's say, thank God, the mother had the brains to do the right thing, because we know there's mothers out there that won't, like Jackie Peterson and, you know, God, so many. My mind is just blank. There's so many others out there with that. Cindy Anthony is another one. She did the right thing. Apparently, from what I understand, she found something, or that the story is that there was something found, and her son confessed to her, and she called the police and had her son talk to the police. So she did the right thing. And I'm sure that must be eating her up inside to no end. Michael, I want to go to you. Let's talk about Jessica Ridgway's family for a moment. What would you tell them in something like this? Obviously, there's no words to make it any better, but unfortunately, you are now part of that club, as Mark Klass says, that nobody wants to belong to, and that's to have a loved one close to you who's been killed. What would you say to Jessica's mother and father?
You know, I mean, I've been dealing with Cielo Lamar's family and Linnea Lomax's family, and even though I've been through something similar to what they've been through, I find it very hard to find the words sometimes. But I just try to tell them that, you know, there are people that love you, and there are people that are here for you if there's anything that they need. And you know, one thing that Mark and Violet told me was that if you want to cry, cry. You know, if you're angry and, you know, you want to scream out, then do that also. Just find ways to find outlets for your frustrations and your emotions, because otherwise they just eat you up.
That is absolutely true. And you'll stick with Mark and Violet, Michael, and you'll have somebody that'll help you along all the way through all the stages, because it doesn't end. But Mark, how do you say to somebody what they'll be feeling in 10 years from now? What advice do you have? Does it ever get better?
Well, time makes things better. I mean, I got my
Oh, I can't hear you, Mark. Where's, yeah,
sorry.
There you are.
I said time makes things better. There's no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you to manage your emotions better as they apply to the tragedy that you've dealt with. And I think finding a way to give meaning to the death of your loved one also helps. I mean, it means that they represent more than a statistic, that there's value in their death as there was value in their life, and that, you know, there's different ways to approach this, Tricia. They call it fright, flight, and fight. And a lot of people are frightened. I mean, they're just scared into isolation by these kinds of tragedies. There are people that never get out of bed, that turn to drugs or excessive alcohol abuse, or depression, whose lives just, you know, are destroyed by things like this. And then there are other people who kind of turn their back on it and try to pretend that it never happened. And then there are those who sort of embrace the tragedy and try to create meaning out of it. And I think ultimately those are the people that fare the best out of these types of situations. And, I mean, that's the route we took. That's the route that Michael and his family are taking. That's the route that so many people follow that's what I encourage people to do.
Well, and hopefully Jessica Ridgway's family will find some peace somehow by perhaps reaching out to other people after all of this nightmare is over and this monster is behind bars for life, and that's where he belongs, death penalty. I would have no problem with him getting the death penalty, but he won't because of his age. Michael, on behalf of Web Sleuths, I just wanted to tell you, if there's ever anything you need, as I told Mr. Cox, we are there for you and your family. If you ever hear of any other cases, although we do talk to Mark and Brad a lot, but if there's any cases you need help with that you might to point our way, we will be glad to help you, Michael, okay?
Thank you, Tricia. And I just want to thank the Web Sleuths community again. When Michelle was missing, I was on the thread every day just looking for new ideas, and I would always bounce them off Inspector Ritchie. And so once again, thank you guys so much for everything you guys do.
Well, thank you, Michael. And this is here's to a long friendship with you and your family and with Class Kids. Mark, always a pleasure. I'm going to keep my fingers crossed and hope to God that a miracle happens and they do not overturn three strikes. It's so absurd. I can't even believe it's happening.
Yeah, well, listen, if all of your listeners in California vote no on Proposition 34 and vote no on Proposition 36, maybe we can turn this around, because I know that you reach an audience of millions and millions.
We do.
And millions.
In fact, it's in the billions now, if you count people in China. Mark, thank you so much. Michael, thank you so much. We'll have you both on very, very soon. And you two take care, okay?
Right. Thank you, Tricia.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. Kimster,
yeah,
are you there?
Wow. Yeah, in fact, can I bring up something? I was going to interrupt you guys in the middle, but I thought I could wait till they were done.
Uh-oh, well, I just hung up on them. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I wanted to mention our CAPER forum, and I can't remember what that stands for, but that's the forum that where you go ahead, because I think you started that.
Citizens Against Pedophiles Early Release is what that is.
Right.
And we had one case on there, Lisa B's case, where we wrote letters to a parole board. Now, her husband had sexually abused her young daughter. It was his stepdaughter, and he was up for parole. And we, as a community, got together and wrote this particular parole board and said, this man should not be let out. He is a pedophile, and pedophiles do not change. And we were hoping that other people would come forward and tell us, you know, about their situations and their parole hearings that are coming up of people they want to keep behind bars that are pedophiles, so we can help them. We're still trying to get that up and going because it works so well with Lisa's case. And we want to use the power of Web Sleuths that we have there to keep pedophiles behind bars. And so, in fact, Lisa and I were just talking about this last week. We're going to try and kick it into gear again and see if we can get another case. If anybody out there knows of a case of a pedophile, and we're talking about the scary people that we do not want to see out ever, you let us know if they're coming up for a parole hearing. We will write letters, and believe me, those letters make a huge difference because nobody writes. We're talking snail mail. Nobody writes snail mail letters anymore, and they read them, and they take them to heart, the parole board. So we can make a difference if we can just find a case. So if anybody has a case of a pedophile coming up for parole, okay, I'm not talking about a kid who might be on the sex offenders list because he was 18 and had sex with his, you know, 16-year-old girlfriend. No, we're talking about the predatory predators who go out there and search for children, whether they try and marry someone with children and shower them with gifts or whatever. It's those type of pedophiles that we want to keep off the streets. So just contact us. Just go to Web Sleuths, click on Contact Us, and send us the information, and we'll kick it into gear. We'll get it rocking. So thank you, Kimster, for bringing that up. I appreciate it.
Well, there's something I want to tell you, too, about that. Thank you for explaining all that. I know a girl whose husband, I was telling these guys about it in the chat room, and this is what made me think about it when Mark was talking about California and the three strikes law and everything. This lady, years ago, her ex-husband saw her with a man who was just a friend, not a new boyfriend or anything, just a friend, came in and murdered the friend right in front of her. And he has been in a California prison for now 28 years. And this I want to bring this up because some people don't hear this aspect of what it does to families, okay? They had three daughters, and these daughters were very young at the time. Well, now they're adults. He has convinced them that their mother is crazy. No. And they were at the parole hearing this year. Two of her three daughters trying to get him out on parole, they're not speaking to her. Let me tell you, she is an outstanding citizen in the community, and she spends her days giving to others. She is one of the kindest women I've ever known.
So stop one second. I want to make sure that we understand what you're saying. The daughters now, who their father killed this man in front of their mother, the daughters now are taking the side of the dad and are not talking to their mother?
Yes, because she's keeping him in, they feel she's keeping him in prison, and they are not being able to have a relationship with their father. This man has shown no remorse at all. As far as she knows, when he's released, he will come after her. Okay. Now, let me tell you, the DA told her there in California that he would get out this year, that there was no doubt, because they're not keeping these kind of offenders in jail.
But he murdered
anymore.
It was just first-degree murder. How in the hell can they let this guy out?
I know, because she's been going to these parole hearings every 5 years since I've known her. I've known her about 15 years. This is the third one she's gone to, so that's how I know that since I've known her. But anyway, you know, I just have to say, it was a lot of prayer was on her side this time. They kept him in. So he's in for another 5 years. Yeah. But she was extremely disturbed and was telling me this morning about, you know, how frightening it is that he may get out this next time. He's ruined many. He hasn't ruined her life. She has a very fulfilled life, you know, with a lot of friends who love her and one daughter who loves her, too. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's ruined her relationship with two of her girls. They've got, you know, tough lives, those two girls. Believe me, they're not living, you know, an easy life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so he's ruined their lives as well. And I told her about Caper this morning, even though it's about sex offenders. I told her about it, and her eyes just swelled up. The thought that people would help keep these these evil people behind bars and held victims just overwhelmed her. And I told her, in 5 years, when he goes up for parole again, remind me. I will have my friends on Web Blues write letters for you.
She
couldn't believe it. She couldn't believe it. So that's how much we mean to victims, you guys. That's what I'm trying. The bottom line is that is how much we mean to victims. They don't, you know, there are things going on in their lives because of these crimes. It's not like, oh, well, they got put away or this or that, or maybe even the death penalty and they're on death row. The lives for the victims are still shattered from what has happened, these crimes and these evil people. So please don't forget it. And if they need something, you ever see they need something that you could actually provide for them, please do it.
Exactly. And Kimster, you be sure and tell your friend that you know people in high places and we'll get it done. We will get it done. Definitely. What we can do is have people in California write and say, I don't want this man out in my society. What the hell? And you know what? We can get media behind it. There's a lot we can do to put pressure on the parole board. And I don't like to do that. I mean, it's rare that I do that because I think when you get the media involved, if we ever do get the media involved in anything, I want it to be something just rock solid and decent and good, because I don't want to come across as a big group of hysterical people every time there's a crime. You know, we go berserk. No, no, no. Not like that at all. I would love to help your friend. So in 5 years, believe me, Web Sleuths, and I'm planning on being here. So we will, I'm sure, be glad to help. Okay, Kimster, it is now time for the Web Sleuths Hot Cold Case of the Week. You have the floor.
Well, Tricia, before we get started on this week's cold case, I'd like to mention a special member on Web Sleuths.
Okay.
And her name is Sooner Fan Number One. And I say is because she's still there, even though Sooner passed away a few weeks ago. And I'm getting the chills right now because I loved her so much. The forum hasn't been the same without her, Tricia. She was concerned about a lot of cases on Web Sleuths, and she was a friend to many of our members. Her presence is still everywhere on Web Sleuths. And Sooner, I want you to know that you will always be missed on Web Sleuths.
Oh, and I second that, Kimster. Sooner was an amazing person and a great example of the people that we have on Web Sleuths. So, Sooner, you're still with us, and you will always be with us because you will always be on Web Sleuths.
Yep. Okay, now it's time. Do, 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 do.
The lovely horn. I swear next week I'm getting you a horn.
I promise.
What is our Web Sleuths hot cold case, my dear?
Here we go. I would like closure. I would like justice to be served. I want to know what happened to her and where she is. If a person has a heart and soul, they should come forward. And, Tricia, those are the words of the mother of China Vidian, 16 years old when she went missing from Christiana, Tennessee in October of 1999. China was last seen at a beauty salon at the Jackson Heights Plaza. She told her mom she planned to get gas for her black 1999 Mazda Protege and then go home. When China's mother arrived home later that day, her daughter wasn't there, and China has never been seen again. At first, they thought China left on her own with an adult male, but now foul play is suspected in her case. In June 2000, her car was found abandoned at an apartment complex off Harding Road in Antioch, Tennessee. Investigators stated that it looked as if the vehicle had been there for a very long time. Some of China's personal property was still inside. Detectives recently released a presser regarding China's disappearance, and they really want to solve this cold case. So let's help them find that one clue that will bring China home to her mom. If you want to try to help solve this case and release China's mom from her grief, please go to www.websleuths.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a picture of China along with a link to her thread. And if you are not a member of Web Sleuths, what do you do, Tricia?
Well, by gosh, you get up and you join because it's absolutely free. We don't ask for your personal information. We don't want your firstborn child. We don't ask for your blood type. And we do ask for an email address. That's all we need. And when you come on Web Sleuths, you just got to behave. It's not like the other forums where you can go around and call people names and call them liars and get back and forth and threaten to kill each other. We don't have that. We have mature discussions, and we keep all the internet trolls out. So you come to Web Sleuths, you can join in the conversation, and you don't have to worry about being attacked like you do on other forums. Kimster, thank you so much again, my dear. It was a wonderful show. I'd like to thank Mark Klass, Chuck Cox, and Michael Lay for joining us. Very, very interesting. And for you, the listener, thank you. You can pass along this link. It'll be up in just a moment. It's the same link that you used to get here. And you can pass it along to those people who perhaps missed the show, the live show tonight. Oh, it's time for the legal goo. I knew I forgot something. The opinions on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the guests and the host. And of course, you know me. I take no responsibility for them. And do remember that Trisha's True Crime Radio is completely separate and different from WebSleuths.com LLC. That is a completely different corporate entity, and of course different than ForumsForJustice.org, another wonderful forum that I happen to own. So Trisha's True Crime Radio is just self-contained. We are what we are, and we'll be back next week. Kimster, thank you so much. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss current events and true crime, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody.